The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Brandy Spragata for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah Magazine. Where did it start? Body positivity started being used as a phrase in the 1990s, says Tigris Osborne, chair of the National Association to Advance Fat Acceptance, or NAFA. In 1996, an organization called The Body Positive was founded by an author who suffered with an eating disorder in her teens and a psychotherapist who specialized in treating eating disorders. But when people talk about body positivity, they are really talking about the social media movement that started in the early 2000s on platforms like Facebook and Tumblr, created by queer people, black women and femmes, fat people, and disabled people. They were building community spaces and social media campaigns around body positivity, uplifting marginalized bodies, and creating media that featured marginalized bodies, says Osborne. The fat liberation movement of the 1960s is one of the grand elders of the body positivity movement, says Osborne. And so are any of the folks who were pushed to the edges of the mainstream beauty standard. But a lot of the language does come from things fat liberationists did in the 70s and 80s, especially fat feminists. NAFA was founded in 1969, dedicated to protecting the rights and improving the quality of life for fat people. For the first time, an organization exists to make life better for fat people without them having to change their bodies, says Osborne. And from there grew the Fat Underground, or a radical offshoot that published the seminal Fat Liberation Manifesto, which demanded equal rights for fat people in all areas of life, highlighted the intersectionality of fat liberation with other oppressed groups, strove to end fat discrimination in the workplace, and called out the diet and health industries, among other things. These founding principles of the manifesto are the same things we see in the early body positivity movement, says Osborne, including the idea that advertisers create beauty standards that aren't realistic, that the medical world is not fair in the treatment of us, that the diet industry is a billion-dollar industry that wants you to think you're terrible so you'll keep spending money. What is the difference between body positivity and fat liberation? Body positivity wants you to feel good about yourself. Fat liberation wants the system to change so you can actually live your life. It's not about your personal self-esteem, it's about access and equity. It's not about inclusion in a feel-good way, it's about inclusion in a practical, logistical way. Can I fit places? Can I be places? Can I be accepted in places? Not just, do I look in the mirror and see something I like, says Osborne. Body positivity is focused on the individual. How do they feel in their bodies? Can they purchase clothes? Can people see themselves in magazines and on TV? Adds Evett Dionne, a culture critic and the author of Weightless, Making Space for My Resilient Body and Soul. Fat acceptance focuses on systems. How does the world at large discriminate, target, and surveil fat bodies, trans bodies, disabled bodies, and anyone perceived as deviant from the norm? Dionne recalls facing fat discrimination as a young child. Fat phobia is very insidious and started affecting me as a child around 8 or 9 years old, she says. I had an asthma attack and was prescribed steroids, which made me gain weight. After that, the doctors only wanted to talk to me about diets. It was odd. Kids began to torment me and I couldn't find clothes that fit. I knew something was wrong. When she was 22, Dionne saw the influencer Gabby Fresh on social media and was wowed. She wore bikinis, which was eye-opening for me. Having that confidence inspired me to find that power within myself. I discovered it wasn't just me feeling this way. Dionne learned about the fat acceptance movement when she was around 25, turning her attention outward toward examining systems and the way they oppress and discriminate against marginalized bodies. I have felt that I stuck out my entire life, says Amy Anderson, a Hudson Valley therapist, educator, and activist, who runs body liberation circles. Feeling othered is a trauma based in both systemic oppression and interpersonal interactions, so I use the phrase body liberation because it turns the issue on its head. What if it was never a self-esteem issue? It's something that started on the outside of us and was reinforced by the messaging we get day in and day out about how we are ranked by skin color, size, gender, ability, and facial symmetry. Fat people are denied access to medical care, clothing, airplanes, restaurants, theaters, jobs. Even though it's starting to get better, representation of fat people in the media is still atrocious, even children's media. My activism work can't just be about healing my relationship with my own body. I'm working to make space for people larger than me, says Anderson. The mainstreaming of body positivity has opened a lot of doors for a lot of people, says Osborne. A lot of dialogue has been created, and some cultural attitude shifts and expanding beauty definitions create a little breathing room. But for people who are still farthest out on the margins, hashtag BOPO isn't changing their lives. When you look at the hashtags for body positivity now, what comes up is a lot of skinny white women posting, "Look how brave I am posting a pic in my bikini after I gained 3 pounds," which is a real erasure of the fat black women who started this movement, says Anderson. This is a sentiment Lizzo shared on TikTok, saying, "Because now that body positivity has been co-opted by all bodies, and people are finally celebrating medium and small girls and people who occasionally get roles, fat people are still getting the short end of this movement. We're still getting shit on, we're still getting talked about, memed, shamed, and no one cares anymore because it's like body positivity is for everybody. Yes, please be positive about your body. Please use our movement to empower yourself. That's the point. But the people who created this movement, big women, big brown and black women, queer women, are not benefiting from the mainstream success of it." When body positivity starts, it is a radical social movement on social media created by people who are farthest from mainstream beauty standards, really demanding their right to be seen, heard, and be themselves as they are without having to fix themselves, says Osborne. But as it gets more popular, it gets more mainstream, and as the marketplace starts to recognize body positivity as something that is really popular, they start to co-opt it in advertising. So it's not the same radical roots at the beginning of body positivity on social media, and it's definitely not the same radical roots as the beginning of fat liberation. What is body neutrality? In her book, What We Don't Talk About When We Talk About Fat, author Aubrey Gordon defines body neutrality as the viewpoint that bodies should be prized for their function, not their appearance, and that simply feeling impartial about our bodies would represent a significant step forward for those of us whose bodies are most marginalized bodies. We don't have to be happy, happy, joy, joy all the time, says Anderson. If someone has a troubled relationship with their body, does that mean they're not invited to the revolution? The expectation that you have to love your body and feel all, yay, my body, it's a lot of pressure that's not just about your internal landscape, says Osborne. It's about the actual practicality of how your body works or how it works in the world, and maybe asking people to feel positive about that is just too much. I don't have to feel crappy about my body, but I don't have to be having a romanticized love affair with my body either. I just have to meet my body where it's at. Osborne also offers that body neutrality gives room for vulnerability. There can be so much vulnerability in taking the steps toward loving your body in a culture that is set up to tell you to not love your body. There are all these messages that tell us our bodies are bad or they're not good enough or we have to fix them or be cured of something. It's beautiful if you can, despite all of that, have a love affair with your body. But there might be days, or it might be every day, that is asking too much of you. The alternative doesn't have to be hating yourself. There can just be acceptance. Where do we go from here? The first step is self-interrogation, says Dion. How do you think about your body and other people's bodies? Interrogate your own biases with fat, trans, and disabled folks, she encourages. Body positivity has been an important stepping stone to get us to where we are now, but there is still a lot of work to do, says Anderson. Explicit body shaming may have gone down a little, but implicit bias is actually up. People make the assumption that fatness is changeable and a choice, and this is largely not the case. There's this idea that bullying someone is somehow healthy for them, which couldn't be farther from the truth, and this type of thinking leads to real harm at every scale. Everyone should be examining their own bias around this issue. There are many great writers who highlight the intersectional experiences of people in fat bodies, and activists are working toward making real systemic long-term change. The best way to help someone to feel good about their body is not a t-shirt that says, "You go, girl." It isn't a pep talk. It's a commitment to justice. Our next article by the editors is titled, "The Details of Princess Diana's Death and the Royal Family's Response." Inevitably, to think about Princess Diana's life is also to think about her sudden death in a car accident, the effects of which still reverberate in the royal family and beyond. After she married Prince Charles, the eldest of Queen Elizabeth II and Prince Philip's four children, in July 1981, Diana Spencer's entire life became tabloid fodder, from marital intrigue to their divorce and its aftermath. Though Diana is remembered for her kindness and advocacy, her death is often thought of as a climax of one long chase for a scoop. A new HBO documentary titled The Princess is exploring her life, death, and legacy once again, this time using archival and video footage. "I'm very aware that this story has been told very widely before," said director Ed Perkins earlier this year. "I felt very strongly that the perspective that hadn't really been explored before wasn't necessarily trying to get inside Diana's head." The documentary tracks Diana's life from her 1981 engagement to Prince Charles all the way through her death, with revelations on their scandal-filled marriage and Diana's often tricky relationship with the press. Let's take a look back at the real-life events that led to her tragic passing. Princess Diana was in a fatal car accident in Paris. On Saturday, August 30th, 1997, Diana and her rumored boyfriend, Egyptian billionaire Ahmad Dodi Fayed, arrived to Paris following a 10-day getaway on the French Riviera. They dined at the private salon at the Ritz Hotel in Paris. Coincidentally, Fayed's father, Mohammed Al-Fayed, owned the hotel at the time, along with Harrods department store in London. A few minutes past midnight on Sunday, Diana and Fayed left the hotel and got into the Mercedes-Benz that was waiting for them, likely to travel to Fayed's private Parisian estate. Though the posted speed limit was 30 miles per hour, the driver, Henry Paul, reportedly approached the entrance of a road tunnel at Paris's Pont de l'Alma, driving at approximately 70 miles per hour. According to reports, Paul lost control of the car and collided into a pillar in the middle of the highway. Paul and Fayed were pronounced dead at the scene, and Diana, still alive, was rushed to the Piti Salpêtrière Hospital. Early reports said Diana was suffering from a concussion, broken arm, and cut thigh. However, the princess had also suffered massive chest injuries. Operating for 2 hours, doctors tried and failed to get Diana's heart beating properly again. She never regained consciousness. Diana passed away from internal bleeding at 4:53 on the morning of August 31, 1997. Her last words are heartbreaking. In her book, The Diana Chronicles, author Tina Brown described the scene of the crash. According to Frederick Malise, an EMT who happened to be driving through the tunnel at the same time of the collision, Diana woke up in pain from internal injuries. She kept saying how much she hurt, Malise told Brown. Sergeant Xavier Gourmelin, who led the response team in Paris, told The Independent Diana's last words were, "My God, what's happened?" Brown narrates what may have happened next. She turned her head and saw the lifeless Dodi just in front of her, then turned her head again toward the front where the bodyguard was writhing and where Henry Paul lay dead. She became agitated, then lowered her head and closed her eyes. Diana ultimately died of a small, rare injury. In 2019, Richard Shepard, Britain's top forensic pathologist, concluded that Diana died of a tiny, badly placed tear in the vein of her lung. "Her specific injury is so rare that in my entire career I don't believe I've seen another," Shepard wrote in his book, Unnatural Causes, excerpted in the Daily Mail. Shepard believes Diana's death could have been prevented by one small change, a seatbelt. Had she been restrained, she would probably have appeared in public 2 days later with a black eye, perhaps a bit breathless from the fractured ribs, and with a broken arm in a sling, Shepard wrote. The only survivor of the crash was Diana's British bodyguard, Trevor Rees-Jones. He had been wearing a seatbelt. Many question what really caused the accident. What caused Henry Paul, the acting head of security at the Ritz Hotel and a licensed driver, to so drastically lose control of the car? According to a statement from French authorities, given the Monday after the crash, Paul's blood exceeded the legal blood alcohol limit. He had reportedly been drinking and driving recklessly. According to eyewitnesses, there was another element involved in the crash. Their black Mercedes was being pursued by paparazzi in cars and on motorcycles, hoping to snatch a photo of the Princess and Fayed. To this day, conspiracy theories about the crash abound. While different, the theories share the same thesis. This was no accident. For example, Mohammed Al-Fayed, Dodi's father, believes Diana was pregnant with his son's child. This was later disproven by forensics. Another theory posits that Diana feared such an attack. In 2003, Diana's former butler published a note Diana had written soon after her divorce from Charles in 1996, at her lowest and most paranoid. "I am sitting here at my desk today in October," she wrote, "longing for someone to hug me and encourage me to keep strong and hold my head high. This particular phase of my life is the most dangerous. X is planning an accident in my car, brake failure, and serious head injury in order to make the path clear for Charles to marry." The conspiracy theories were all debunked. In 2004, the British Metropolitan Police launched an investigation into the rumors that proliferated around the accident. The findings of Operation Paget, as the investigation was called, were released in 2006. In short, the police found nothing to substantiate Mohammed Al-Fayed's claims of conspiracy, and neither did anyone else. Operation Paget disposed of every substantive allegation. So did the official French inquiry. And so did independent investigations, notably Martin Gregory's Diana, The Last Days. The evidence is overwhelming that this was a traffic accident, period, Brown writes in the Diana Chronicles. Paparazzi at the scene allegedly took photos instead of calling for help. Diana, arguably the most famous woman in the world, lived her life constantly pursued by paparazzi. Perhaps it's no surprise that evidence of her death was similarly captured, but it's certainly shocking. According to Stéphane Darman, a motorcycle rider for one of the paparazzi who chased the Mercedes that night, the paparazzi present at the scene did not help the car's doomed passengers. Instead, they took photos. "I did not see the car anymore because the light of the flashes was so bright. It was continuous," Darman told The Guardian in 2008. In the immediate aftermath of the accident, 7 French photographers were arrested and questioned by the police. According to the New York Times, charges of manslaughter were brought against 9 photographers who followed the Mercedes and took photos after the crash, but they were not found guilty. However, 3 photographers were found guilty of invasion of privacy and were fined a symbolic €1. In the 2021 Apple TV Plus documentary, The Me You Can't See, Prince Harry speaks about the anger he felt about the fallout of his mother's death. "I was so angry with what happened to her and the fact that there was no justice at all. Nothing came from that. The same people that chased her into the tunnel photographed her dying on the backseat of that car," he says. Diana was 36 years old at the time of her death. When she was 20, Diana Spencer became Princess of Wales in a lavish wedding ceremony at St. Paul's, televised to a global audience of 750 million. So much would happen in the next 16 years. In 1996, Diana and Charles would divorce. The following year, when she was 36, Diana would leave behind her young sons. After the accident, Prince William and Prince Harry were shielded from the public. Diana and Charles' 2 sons, Prince William and Prince Harry, aged 15 and 12, were vacationing at Balmoral Castle in Scotland at the time of the crash. Understandably, they were devastated by their mother's death. According to Prince William, Queen Elizabeth II shielded her grandsons from the ensuing news spectacle. Back then, obviously, there were no smartphones or anything like that, so you couldn't get your news, and thankfully at the time, to be honest, we had the privacy to mourn and collect our thoughts and to have that space away from everybody, William said in a 2017 BBC documentary. We had no idea that the reaction to her death would be quite so huge. The brothers have only recently begun to open up about how this devastating and highly public loss affected them. I really regret not ever talking about it, Prince Harry said at an event for a mental health charity in 2016. For the first 28 years of my life, I never talked about it. It is okay to suffer, but as long as you talk about it, it's not a weakness. Weakness is having a problem and not recognizing it and not solving that problem. Harry has since become an advocate for mental health awareness. Queen Elizabeth II waited 5 days to publicly address Diana's death. The Queen came under close scrutiny after Diana's death, a plot point that will surely be explored in future seasons of The Crown. In fact, Crown creator Peter Morgan already explored the topic in the film The Queen, which is about the 5 days between Diana's death and the Queen's public speech. After the accident, Queen Elizabeth chose to stay with Harry and William in Balmoral, Scotland, and was planning to return just before the funeral. However, in not immediately addressing a nation in mourning, the Queen and the royal family were criticized for being aloof. Mary Frances, an aide to the Queen, was struck firsthand at the contrast between the world's very vocal reaction to Diana's death and the royal family's silence. This was primarily a family that had been struck by a personal tragedy, especially for the grandchildren of the Queen, and so that was the first reaction, Frances told Newsweek in 2017. But I think that the family were somewhat slow, perhaps, to recognize the need to step forward in their public role of showing leadership for the country and its grief about the death of the princess. Eventually, on September 9, 1997, the Queen addressed the nation in her first live broadcast since the Gulf War in 1991. We have all felt those emotions in these last few days. So what I say to you now as your queen and as a grandmother, I say from the heart, the Queen said, beginning her speech. First, I want to pay tribute to Diana myself. She was an exceptional and gifted human being. In good times and bad, she never lost her capacity to smile and laugh, to inspire others with her warmth and kindness. I admired and respected her for her energy and commitment to others, especially for her devotion to her two boys. Diana's funeral was unprecedented. Diana's funeral was held on September 6, 1997. Like her wedding, the funeral was a spectacle. 750 million watched Diana get married on TV, and 2.5 billion watched her funeral procession. One of the most striking and controversial images from the day were of young Harry and William walking beside their mother's coffin as it traveled from Buckingham Palace to Westminster Cathedral. My mother had just died, and I had to walk a long way behind her coffin, surrounded by thousands of people watching me while millions more did on television, Harry told Newsweek in a 2017 cover story. I don't think any child should be asked to do that under any circumstances. I don't think it would happen today. Reflecting on the day and the me you can't see, Harry said he was outside his body during her funeral. The thing I remember the most was the sound of the horse's hooves going along the pavement, along the mall, the red brick road. It was like I was outside of my body and just walking along, doing what was expected of me, showing one-tenth of the emotion that everybody else was showing. And this was my mom. You never even met her, he said. Prince William agrees. It was one of the hardest things I've ever done, that walk, Princess William shared in a 2017 BBC documentary called Diana, 7 Days. It felt she was almost walking along beside us to get us through it. During the funeral, people reflected on the attention that defined Diana's life and death. Diana's brother, Lord Spencer, blamed the media for the crash and called his sister the most hunted person of the modern age. Elton John performed a rendition of his famous 1973 song Candle in the Wind, with the lyrics reworked to be about Diana instead of Marilyn Monroe, who also experienced vast media intrusions. The 1997 version of Candle in the Wind remains the best-selling chart single of all time, and in a rare break in royal protocol, the Queen bowed her head as Diana's coffin went past. Diana was buried at Althorp, her family's estate in Northamptonshire, England. Her death deeply impacted many people. The news broke late on a Saturday night. Around the world, news broadcasts and an episode of Saturday Night Live were interrupted so that visibly stricken announcers could share what had transpired. If you were old enough to form memories on August 31, 1997, then chances are you remember where you were when you heard that Princess Diana had died. It was a moment in which the world stopped, and a moment that many fans of Diana still remember vividly. Career coach Rebecca Andruska was a college freshman, smoking cigarettes on her dorm room stoop with her freshly acquired friends, when she heard the news. A girl ran out and announced to the whole block Princess Di was in a car accident and burst into tears, Andruska Sketz said to OprahMag.com. Writer and researcher Tracy Vogel had the uncanny experience of disembarking from a red-eye flight into a changed world. Diana had died while Vogel was in the air. I walked through an eerily silent airport full of groups of people watching TV, many crying, Vogel said. For social media editor Sophie Virschbau, Diana's death is a formative childhood memory. My British cousin was visiting with her friend. They were beyond inconsolable, sobbing and huddled down in the guest room. I remember it as the first time I saw intense grief on display, Virschbau recalled. The stories go on and on. Diana and Meghan Markle share a connection. Meghan Markle was among the young women deeply affected by Diana's death. She and her friends watched the funeral of Diana, Princess of Wales, tears coursing down their cheeks at the poignant moment when the camera zoomed in on the royal coffin, Andrew Morton wrote in his unofficial biography of Markle. At the time, of course, 16-year-old Markle couldn't know she would one day marry Diana's younger son, Harry, or that she'd be plagued by the same tabloids that hounded Diana literally to the death. In 2020, Harry and Markle took a stand against British media by filing lawsuits against various tabloid publications. In HBO's The Princess, the documentary asks viewers to question if our media culture has really improved since Diana's untimely death. Today, Harry says he's living the life Diana wanted to live for herself. When Diana died, she was still in the process of defining her post-royal existence. Harry stepped back from his duties as a royal in 2020. Now, at the age of 37, a year older than Diana was when she died, Harry believes he's continuing on in her legacy. I have no doubt that my mom would be incredibly proud of me. I'm living the life that she wanted to live for herself, living the life that she wanted us to be able to live. So not only do I know that she's incredibly proud of me, but that she's helped me get here, and I've never felt her presence more than I have over the last year. I wish she could have met Meghan. I wish she was around for Archie, Harry said in the Me You Can't See. Diana's legacy continues to affect the royals' lives, and her life continues to inspire and fascinate ours. Our next article by Jennifer G. Sullivan is titled, How to Make a Fragrance Memory of a Place You Love. Experimental psychologist Pamela Dalton doesn't remember the first time she smelled cilantro. If she had to associate the scent with something or some place, it would probably be the supermarket where she sniffed it to confirm what it wasn't, parsley. But that changed a few years ago when she was traveling through Vietnam. She was wandering around a night market around 2 a.m. and the air was redolent with the earthy citrus aroma of cilantro. She says the intensity was overwhelming. To this day, when she smells cilantro, she's transported. It all comes back to me, the experience of walking through that market, the chatter of the vendors, it's like I'm there again. Dalton knows this experience is special because, as a researcher at the Monell Chemical Synthesis Center in Philadelphia, it's part of her job to study the relationship between scent and memory. She explains that her brain created a new association with an odor, something that doesn't happen that often by adulthood when many scents are familiar. Familiar scents don't become uniquely associated with new places unless there's something emotional going on, she explains. In Dalton's case, the moment was emotional. She was on vacation experiencing the joy of discovery. But, she says, the herbal scent was also unfamiliar, sweeter and more perfumed than supermarket cilantro. Scent memories, whether they're linked to a location or not, tend to be more emotionally charged than memories triggered by sounds or visual cues. This is because the olfactory bulb in the brain that processes smells is directly connected to both the amygdala, the brain's emotional center, and the hippocampus, which is responsible for encoding memories in the brain. In fact, last year, researchers using advanced neuroimaging techniques found that our olfactory system is more strongly connected to the hippocampus than our sensory systems for other senses like vision, touch, and hearing. In December, a different group of scientists studying rats discovered olfactory neurons that can encode spatial maps of different locations. For some reason, evolution has granted our brains the ability to link an odor with a location, says Dalton. Scientists are just starting to understand the intersection of location and scent, but perfumers have been exploring these connections for years. There are entire fragrance collections like Memo Paris and Gallivant, designed to evoke destinations through scent. And many of the best perfumes have the ability to transport. With its orange blossom and green cactus pepper notes, DS and Dirge's new scent, Sweet Do Nothing, bottles West Texas in the spring, while Aaron Mediterranean Honeysuckle Mimosa captures a summer day on the French Riviera. And have you ever noticed how the aromas of certain hotels and resorts get lodged in your memory? That's often intentional, says Don Goldworm, co-founder of the olfactive branding firm 12.29. Smell is the most acute way for a brand to create a connection with a customer, and often that emotional, tangible connection translates into loyalty, she says. La Sera News in Pasciano, Italy, was one of the first resorts with a signature fragrance, but Sebastian Alvarez Marina, whose wife's family founded the hotel, says it wasn't a branding exercise. They simply wanted to commemorate La Serenus' 50th anniversary, which had passed without fanfare. A party in the fall of 2001 was canceled because of 9/11. In the spring of 2002, Marina, his wife Marina Sursale, and a few other family members were on the hotel's terrace discussing ways to celebrate when someone came up with the idea of doing a fragrance. 2 years later, they released Eau de Tali, which is notes of black currant, magnolia, and bergamot, the legendary aroma of the Amalfi Coast. But the thing that makes it special is a unique accord reminiscent of the terrace where the project was conceived. Argyle, says Morena, using the French word for clay. Throughout the hotel, there are terracotta tiles and vases, as well as amphorae. When the sun hits them in the summer, the air is perfumed with their sweet and dusty mineral scent. I can't explain why it's so popular. I'm not a psychologist, says Morena. But people wear Eau de Tali, and it reminds them of La Serenus, of Pasciano, of happy times. These days, resorts with signature scents are ubiquitous. The Sheraton Carlsbad Resort and Spa infuses its rooms with a blend of fig, bergamot, jasmine, and freesia. The black tea fragrance of Edition Hotels is available in candle form and scents all their Le Labo toiletries. Goldworm, who has developed fragrances for Thompson Hotels and Ritz-Carlton properties, says turning a location into a fragrance is an art, and she often relies on color to facilitate the journey. If you ask someone to describe how a certain place smells, they usually don't have the word, she says. But color helps to bridge the part of the brain that smells with the part of the brain that speaks. Goldworm says that people all around the world tend to associate the same smells with the same colors, so when she begins a new project, that's often where she starts. When I created a scent for the Montage Resort in Cabo San Lucas, Mexico, the team there wanted me to look at the local plants and flowers, but they also wanted me to watch the sunset, she says. Hotel guests say the Pacific sunsets, fiery reds, intense oranges, soft yellows, are one of the best things about the location. The fragrance, Goldworm designed, plays off the colors of that ocean sky at dusk. We use lemon-like bergamot and a juicy mandarin. Will lighting a candle or spraying a perfume replace a vacation? Of course not. But don't underestimate smell's ability to uplift, transport, and even orient you. Dalton says most people don't recognize that power until it's gone, as some COVID-19 patients understand firsthand. Those who experience anosmia, or a loss of smell, report feeling disoriented and lost. They're describing their emotional state, but perhaps the choice of words hints at something deeper. Dalton interviewed a flight attendant years ago who'd been in a car accident and sustained a brain injury that caused anosmia. When she began traveling again for work, she often had trouble remembering where she was. She almost didn't know which city she was in because she didn't have the smells, the scent of a metro or a market to ground her, says Dalton. You can also pre-plan your scent memory. Next time you travel, pack a fragrance you haven't worn before and use it throughout the trip. Then reach for it in the future whenever you want to be reminded of your vacation. Or whenever you find yourself somewhere new this summer, take a moment to stop and really smell the roses, or the market air, terracotta tiles, or a salty sunset. You just may make a memory that lasts a lifetime. Our next article by Brittany Gaston is titled, Here's the Scoop on Robin S., the diva who inspired Beyoncé's Break My Soul. Numerous headlines as of late may convince you that Beyoncé single-handedly resurrected house music with the release of Break My Soul, the lead single off her Renaissance album, which dropped on July 29th. But the genre's roots can actually be traced all the way back to the early 80s, thanks to the genius of its Black founding fathers Frankie Knuckles and Marshall Jefferson. Renaissance, the title for Beyoncé's highly anticipated seventh solo studio album, given the fact that Renaissance is a French word meaning rebirth. Dance music is experiencing a resurgence, and it appears that Beyoncé certainly did her research, since Break My Soul samples one of the most definitive house tracks of all time, Robin S.'s Show Me Love. But as it turns out, the unforgettable version of Show Me Love that dominated radio airwaves nearly 30 years ago almost never came to exist. Known to her postmaster as Robin Stone, the Queens native started singing in her church choir at 5 years old. Stone's talent was hard to ignore, and she had a vocal coach by the time she was 8. Stone wasn't the only singer in the family. Her father sang in a quartet for the World's Fair in the U.S. As a teenager, she began performing throughout Manhattan, citing Nancy Wilson, Anita Baker, Nina Simone, Phyllis Hyman, Patti LaBelle, Lena Horne, Annie Lennox, and Bonnie Raitt as early influences. "I was in a couple of cover bands," Stone recalled in a 2018 interview with Classic Pop magazine. "New York Soul Syndicate and Top Shelf. We sang all the top 20 R&B songs." Office administrator by day and chanting songstress at night, Stone was performing at one of her regular gigs when producers Alan George and Fred McFarlane approached her to demo a song. "I did so," she said, thinking nothing of it. Under the name Robin Stone, the original version of Show Me Love, the Montego mix, released in 1990, was distributed through Champion Records, but in Stone's own words, the record flopped. Returning to life as usual, Stone continued working her day job while Show Me Love faded to memory. It wasn't until Swedish DJ Stonebridge, born Sten Hallström, got a hold of the flopped demo that everything changed for the singer. Hallström had been releasing remixes under his aptly titled label Remixed Recording for years when he linked up with Champion Records. Telling him about the failed project that had a great vocal, the company asked the Swede to add his remix touch to Show Me Love. The Swedish DJ created three different remixed versions of the track, and all three versions were rejected by the company. Licking his wounds, Hallström went back to the drawing board, and this time he stripped the track down to just the kick, drum, and vocal, and changed the bass to mimic an organ sound. After adding snare drums, filtered kicks, and a few synthy chords, Stonebridge's edit was done in just a little over 4 hours. Though he liked this new version, he was apprehensive about sending it to Champion Records for fear they'd reject yet another remix, but his then-girlfriend encouraged him to submit the edit. When Stone heard Stonebridge's version, she felt like the song had been reborn. "His remix and my vocal, it was a perfect marriage," Stone said of the remix in the same interview with Classic Pop magazine. The secret sauce? Instead of wailing saxophones, robot vocal FX, and down-tempo snares, the Stonebridge remix instantly draws in listeners with distorted bass lines and crash cymbals that build into the song's main organ melody. As if that weren't enough of an attention grabber, Stone's vocal pierces through the chords, creating one of the most recognizable intros in dance music history. Re-releasing in 1993 on Big Beat Records, Stone dropped her full name and Robin S. was born. At its peak, Stonebridge's revitalized version of Show Me Love peaked at number one on Billboard's Dance Club Songs chart and even reached number five on Billboard's Hot 100. Stone's debut album, Show Me Love, was also a global chart climber, climbing U.S., Canadian, U.K., Dutch, and German charts upon its release, which solidified Stone as one of the most iconic voices in dance music. She maintains a low profile these days, but the success of 1993's Show Me Love made her a household name, earning her a performance at the legendary Apollo Theater, and she commanded the stage during a house music tribute performance at the 2019 Black Girls Rock Awards. Not to mention, she's still touring the world. To think, if it weren't for a persistent producer, the talents of a little-known DJ, and an encouraging girlfriend, Show Me Love as we know it would have never seen the light of day. Moreover, Beyoncé's Break My Soul may not have found its way to the dance floors. Shortly after the surprise release of Break My Soul, Stone thanked Beyoncé for breathing new life into the classic track, saying she'd be thrilled to collaborate with the 28-time Grammy-winning artist in the near future. "Thank you so much for giving me my flowers while I'm still alive," she said during a recent appearance on Good Morning Britain. "I'm honored and excited to see what else can happen." Our next article by Geraldine Brooks is titled "Horsewoman: It's Never Too Late to Learn a New Skill." Chardon is not a large horse. At least, I didn't think so when the little girl led him into the ring and started warming him up for me. He's a compact Dutch Arabian with a lovely copper coat. But once I was in the saddle, the ground suddenly looked very far away. It was my very first riding lesson. We started off simply walking around the arena. Every circuit took us past a sign that read, "Warning." Under Massachusetts law, an equine professional is not liable for any injury to or death of a participant resulting from the inherent risks of equine activities. My equine professional tells me it's time to pick up a trot. She explains the mechanism of posting or rising in time with the horse's motion. When you're ready, just squeeze with both heels, gently. He's very well trained. In fact, he's a message champion, full name El Chardon von Belchok, and the minute I brush his sides, he's off, his gait like a set of powerful pistons. As he flings me upward, I try to locate some core muscles. We're going quite fast. The or death sign comes into my line of sight even more frequently. Wobbling in the stirrups, I wonder if this is such a good activity for a 53-year-old. Knitting, perhaps. Pottery? Anything, really, that doesn't require a death liability disclaimer. I'm coming to horses late because I did not grow up in the kind of suburb where little girls got riding lessons. I understood that this was so far beyond any reasonable ambit claim of childhood desire that I never even craved briar toys or checked out horsey novels from the library. The only equines I saw in our inner city neighborhood belonged to the mounted police. Their arrival was an occasion of some excitement. My mother, hearing the clop of hooves on the blacktop, would run down the street, dustpan in hand, braving busy traffic to scoop up manure for her rose bushes. I admired horses in a kind of vague aesthetic way. I understood it would be marvelous to have a relationship with one, sort of like a very large dog. When I started writing historical fiction, people in my books had horses, and I enjoyed creating these steeds, giving them glossy black coats or roan speckles and personalities that were biddable or fiery as the story demanded. It is painfully clear to me now that I had no idea what I was talking about. The horse care, as I have described it, is entirely suboptimal, and no one in their right mind gallops a horse downhill. Then, in the fall of 2008, I was invited to a writer's retreat at a picturesquely shabby resort ranch in Santa Fe. My room overlooked corrals full of Appaloosas and Western paints. I was draped over the split rail fence admiring them when the wrangler asked me if I'd like to ride. I don't know how. You don't need to. These horses know their job. They won't let you fall off. For some reason, I believed him. The next afternoon, I followed as he led the way through pink arroyos fragrant with acacia. My horse was so sure-footed that even cantering along a cliff edge seemed relaxing and unremarkable. Back home, just a week later, I was telling my friend Katie about this transcendent experience. She looked at my window, pensive. "You've got a few acres here. You could have a horse." She paused. "In fact, I could give you my horse. I've been worried about finding a good home for her." There were many things I might have said at that point, many questions I could have asked. Instead, I made arrangements to fence half my property and turn my tool shed into a stall. A free horse! I signed up for riding lessons and began to explore the finer points of horse transportation. This horse was not close by. In fact, this horse was in Mexico. Katie, a young entrepreneur, had been running a restaurant in San Miguel de Allende for a few years, but had got tired of the grind and was ready to move on. Now that I'd agreed to adopt her 10-year-old Palomino quarter horse, she was free to embark on her next adventure. I should say that Mantequilla was a beautiful horse, so beautiful that she'd starred in an ad. It was for a swift-acting antifungal cream that treats vaginal yeast infections. Horse gallops, voiceover, something should be fast. In the months it took to build fences and find a horse transporter, I needed a vehicle with the kind of springy floor that protects delicate hocks, pasterns, fetlocks, and stifles over long distances. Plus a Wrangler versed in complicated border formalities and evading drug cartels. I watched that ad a couple hundred times. As well as learning a great deal of new information about hocks, pasterns, fetlocks, and stifles, I also kept taking riding lessons. My second lesson was not on Chardon. Chardon was a full-size horse, and after meeting me, the equine professional had noticed that I wasn't strictly speaking a full-sized adult. She decided I could learn instead on Delilah, a large Welsh cob pony. From my point of view, and probably Chardon's, this was a great idea. The ground was a lot closer, and Delilah didn't leap around in the air like the horsey version of Nureyev. There were many lessons that winter and into the spring. Like novelists and clergy, equine professionals rely on a large store of metaphor. At various times, I was instructed to think of myself as a melting ice cream, a tower of wooden blocks, a puppet on a string. To imagine that between my butt and the saddle was one of my grandmother's treasured Wedgwood plates, that in my hands were a pair of baby birds, that I was on a rotating bar stool, that I was carrying a tray of expensive canapés. In between these visualizations, I also needed to obey a string of physical instructions. Hands down, eyes up, soft elbows, don't grip with your knees, more pressure for your calf, keep those heels down, don't jam those heels down, remember to breathe. And perhaps most useful, if you're going to fall, grab the mane. That's why God put it there. There were blissful moments. The first time I cantered on Delilah, it was as if a rocking horse had suddenly come to life. The sound of the air changed, and we seemed to be flying. Of course, I couldn't steer and canter at the same time. My efforts to avoid running my pony right into the or death sign were met by giggles from the little girls busily sailing their mounts over oxers or executing artful pee-offs and pirouettes. In the barn, after lessons, those same little girls giggled as I mixed up the headstall and the brow band, the cantle and the pommel, the cooler and the rain sheet. But gradually I learned these things, as well as the relative nutritional value of first and second cut hay, of timothy pellets, and alfalfa. How to pick hooves, clean sheaths, dress wounds, administer dewormers. I had ample time. Months had passed, yet Mantequilla remained in San Miguel. I won't detail the delays and frustrations inherent in dealing with two governments and a volatile border. Luckily, my friend Katie was a resourceful and persuasive young woman, and her connections were good enough to locate Mario, perhaps the only man with the skill set to pull off a journey that had just got several hundred miles longer, since the closest crossing point had been closed due to extreme violence in the area. By the time the horse trailer pulled into our driveway on July 4th weekend, the price tag for my free horse was well north of $10,000. But she was so beautiful. Katie came over and showed my son how to ride her around the yard bareback. After she'd rested for a few days, I took her out for our first trail ride. It went fine after the bit where, because I hadn't properly adjusted the girth, I ended up riding upside down under her belly. I look back on that trail ride now, and I truly believe that God protects stupid people. For some reason, Mantequilla let me take her alone into dense woods, which would have been entirely strange to a horse from the Alto Plano. I did not know enough then to realize that her heavy breathing and wildly swiveling ears indicated a terrified horse who would have been quite justified in pitching me over a cliff and running for it. And maybe that my ignorance protected me. My relaxed, euphoric state may have given her just enough reassurance to get us home before she had a nervous breakdown. Within a month, Mantequilla had figured out that I didn't have a clue. She had been raised on a working ranch with hard-handed cowboys and then ridden by Katie, who was expert and fearless. By the time autumn segged into severe Massachusetts winter, Mantequilla, unused to the cold, was in a foul mood and thoroughly pissed with my lack of competence. My equine professional was giving me a lesson in the backyard when Mantequilla bucked, and no amount of mane grabbing was going to keep me from hitting the very hard ground. "We usually try to get back on," my instructor noted. "Yes," I said from the ground, "I will." "But you have to stand up first." That proved to be a bit of a stumbling block. As well as learning hocks and stifles, thanks to Mantequilla, I am now more knowledgeable about human anatomy. I know that there's a bone in the pelvis called a superior remus. I had broken mine. As I learned to use the crutches and adjusted to sleeping on the sofa because I couldn't do stairs, I sought advice as to how to make Mantakea happier. I ordered every book I could find on horse care, equine psychology, and better riding skills. I quickly concluded that Mantakea, a herd animal, had been psychologically abused by the lack of a stablemate. So we welcomed Maisie, a cute miniature horse with a big personality. I had a saddle fitter come, a horse masseuse, a vet with a portable ultrasound. I got a new farrier, a whole bunch of dietary supplements. Including the orthopedist bills, the price of my free horse was now edging over $20,000. But the real cost was that I wasn't getting any work done. The novel I was supposed to be writing languished. All I wanted to think about was horses. I was making up for all the Pony Club books I hadn't read in childhood, devouring the entire Jane Smiley collection. Not just her adult titles, such as Horse Heaven, but also her entire YA series, The Horses of Oak Valley Ranch. Just at the point when the red ink looked set to overtake the balance sheet, I heard about a 19th century American racehorse with an extraordinary story and managed to convince my publisher to let me write a novel about him. My obsession could now be passed off as research. Once I got to the point where I only needed to use crutches part of the time, Mantakea and I resumed lessons. I moved to a smaller barn with fewer little girls and more women of a certain age who didn't giggle. Also, the or death sign was in the parking lot, not the riding ring, so I didn't have to look at it more than once per lesson. I bought a vest that worked like a personal airbag. If you leave the saddle unintentionally, a CO2 canister explodes, the vest inflates, and you're the Michelin man before you hit the ground. When Mantakea reared on the trail and dumped me in the bushes, I didn't break a thing. Maisie had been a big success for Mantakea. She loved her little companion. She loved her so much that if I separated them, say to go riding, she would find a way to throw me and bolt back to the barn. Like a woman in an abusive relationship, after every incident, I kept hoping that things between us would somehow be different. We were going to make it work. I was certain of it. And then there was that one last lesson. She was acting up, and my teacher suggested she hop on and work the kinks out a bit. Mantakea bucked. My instructor recentered herself, and the horse bucked again, spinning as if she were auditioning for the rodeo. When my equine professional got off the ground and dusted herself down, I accepted that I had to make a new plan for this horse. She now belongs to an expert young rider with long blonde hair that exactly matches Mantakea's mane. They understand each other. Together, they won the teen division of the Connecticut Barrel Racing Championships. Meanwhile, I learned of a small 20-year-old mare named Valentine. She was calm, gentle, exquisitely trained, never bucked or reared, and had a sense of humor. She lived 10 minutes' drive from my house. For my 60th birthday, I bought myself a pony. Our last article by Robin Moreno is titled, The Best Sleep Apps to Help You Achieve Quality Slumber. Beyonce once said, having peace, happiness, and healthiness is my definition of beauty. And you can't have any of that without sleep. Sleep is essential for pretty much everything good in our lives, yet we just don't get enough of it. According to the CDC, a full third of American adults report they lack the crucial sleep they need. With general life stresses and strains like finances and relationships all contributing to trouble getting to and staying asleep, it can have a real negative impact on your life. Lack of quality sleep can worsen your physical and mental health. And because we are all better living, look up some of the best sleep apps to help you get back on track and get those precious Z's. Calm. Why we love it. With guided breathing exercises, a myriad of sleep sounds, calming meditations, daily how did you sleep check-ins, and bedtime stories narrated by A-listers like Harry Styles and Matthew McConaughey in his soothing Texas drawl, this top-rated app is an all-around winner for helping you get a restful night's slumber. Available on the Apple App Store and Google Play. Price, 7-day free trial, then $69.99 a year. Insight Timer. Why we love it. This engaging app offers all kinds of contents geared to getting you snoozing. It boasts a specific sleep section with thousands of free music tracks and stories to help you sleep, from rain and river sounds to tropical thunder, as well as bedtime tales, sleep meditations, yoga classes for better sleep, and even guided meditations for your kids. Because the app has instructors from around the globe, you can find live content nearly any time of day or night to help you rest and relax. Available on the Apple App Store and Google Play. Price free or $59.99 for Member Plus. Round Glass Living, why we love it. Part of Round Glass, a new company geared to holistic well-being, the app is part of the organization's mission to offer a preventative approach to health. Round Glass Living is easy to navigate, pretty to scroll through, and offers specific sleep meditations, tracks, and tips that, true to their mission, tackle all the reasons one might have trouble sleeping. Plus, the app offers a diverse group of instructors, creating a space that feels welcoming and inclusive. Available on the Apple App Store and Google Play. Price free. Sleep Cycle, why we love it. The Swedes really prize their sleep. So it's no wonder they created an app that helps track your sleep so you can slumber not only longer, but better. The app tracks sleeping patterns through your microphone, checking on your movement and breathing, and wakes you up when you're sleeping the lightest so you have a gentle re-entry back into the waking world. Plus, Scandi hottie Alexander Skarsgård will read you a bedtime story, making your sleep ritual something to enjoy instead of stress about. Or Google Play and App Gallery. Price, 7-day free trial, then $39.99 premium. The app tracks sleeping patterns through your microphone, checking on your movement and breathing, and wakes you up when you're sleeping the lightest so you have a gentle re-entry back into the waking world. Plus, Scandi hottie Alexander Skarsgård will read you a bedtime story, making your sleep ritual something to enjoy instead of stress about. Available on the Apple App Store, Google Play, and App Gallery. Price, 7-day free trial, then $39.99 premium. We have run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I'm Brandi Spragata, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Oprah Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.